important to introduce our next guest.
Just before we do that, can we all just stand briefly to leave the bottom for a second?
Our next guest speaker is Dr. Helen Roundtree. She's with the Department of Sociology at Old Dominion University. Dr. Roundtree's specialty is the history and culture of Indian and Eastern Virginia from the 16th century onward. She has conducted field work among the modern Indians of the region and researched their history since 1959. She joined the faculty of Old Dominion University in 1968, and she teaches courses in cultural anthropology, North American Indians, the Middle East, Women's and Men's Studies. Dr. Roundtree will be speaking of the cultural changes of Eastern Virginia Indians up until today.
I don't like podium, so I'm not going to use it. Can you all hear me back there? I'm fighting heat fever today. My voice feels as if it's down on my toes somewhere. I'll make it a little louder. Can you hear that? Okay, if I go completely hoarse, somebody find me a mic. I'm supposed to be covering actually two subjects. Culture change is one of them. And the prevalence of an Indian identity in the present day in Virginia is the other. So I'm actually going to be wearing two hats, one right after the other. And one, I'm going to be an ethnohistorian who is mucked about with the records and also inquired about oral tradition. And the second hat I'm going to be wearing is that of the cultural anthropologist who is interested in ethnic groups all over the world. I'm supposed to do this in 25 minutes. It's going to be selective, needless to say. So far as the culture change is concerned, I'm only going to be hitting four areas of people's culture. And I'll be doing that in a lot less words than I'd really like to do. I'm going to be talking about the Indian economy, including clothing and housing, since it was introduced here. I'm going to be talking about Indian political organization. I'm going to be talking about Indian education, formal and otherwise. And lastly, I'm going to be talking about Indian religion, including the conversion to Christianity. And all of that, I hope, in about 15 minutes. Almost going to be an outline. I hope you bear with me. If it's just like a laundry list of stuff, that's fine. And if you want to hear more about specific things later, great, ask me. So far as the Indian economy was currently concerned and the material culture, as Jim said, these things did change very, very slowly. They did not directly relate to the downfall of the Powhatan Empire after 1646. The Algonquin Indian culture in eastern Virginia was a very well-established and very resilient thing, particularly the economic aspect of it, as long as the land base held out. It was, after all, an economy that was adapted beautifully to the region. It had thousands of years to become so. Therefore, you find Indian people not adapting to English ways with any great rapidity until they absolutely had to. The English tried, for instance, to get Indian people to adopt various of the European domesticated animals. Cattle in particular. Give them a cow and they're going to get civilized, according to one of the laws passed in the 1650s. Indian folks didn't take to cattle or horses especially because these are animals that need pasture. And pasture is a waste of good territory. Instead, Indian folks took, like a duck takes the water, to raising pigs. Pigs are forest creatures. They don't really belong in pens. They're forest creatures. And all you have to do is turn them loose out in this forest in which you have got plenty. And when you are ready to have pork for dinner, you proceed to go out and hunt the pigs. And hunting is men's work, a very high status of that. So people caught on real fast to pigs. It's that kind of adaptation that you see Indian people doing. They select some things and they reject others. The Indian mode of dress is rather poorly reported, unfortunately, in the 18th century, and our data that we have is promoted. The reservation people were always more visible because they were sticking out front with that land they had. So my data here is promoted. The point 1710 with the pictures that we saw on the ship. So somewhere between 1710 and 1759, you got a change among the colonial. With the non-reservation folks who had lost their land in the early 18th century, and that most of them retreated to lesser lands that the English didn't want, usually swampy areas. These were more isolated places. They got away from the whites, and it is probable that they adopted English modes of dress later. The Indian mode of dress was adopted over thousands of years to the kind of climate that we had here. English modes of dress with heavy woolens were not well adapted, particularly in the summer. You could die of sweat. So people probably kept their old modes of dress as long as they could, unless they were laughed at in getting too much contact with the English. And I think that's why the Pamunkey changed as early as they did in the mid-18th century, so much for dress. Housing was even more conservative. These longhouses, which the Powhatan called Yehul Khans, had not been given up, even on the Pamunkey Reservation, with visitors coming in and laughing at them, when Andrew Burnaby came to in 1759. Why, after all, give up a kind of housing that was not only practical, it was dead cheap? Cutting logs in order to make a log cabin, which is the next stage along, is extra hard work for men who were already burdened with trying to feed their families. Why on earth should they take it up? Extra work, and they were not that interested in being bothered. The old-style houses clung on for a long time. According to Indian oral tradition, which is all that I've got to go on, and it's all that Frank Speck and James Moody had to go on about housing, you begin to find log cabins becoming more common. Again, reservation data we've got here, becoming more common in about the mid-19th century. And by the 1860s to 70s, apparently everyone was living in log cabins by that time, and the Yehul Khans were not being built any longer. Frame houses, even more expensive to build, and these came later. And you find this not only in Virginia, you find it all up and down the East Coast. It was lots of trouble, it was expensive, and if you're talking about poor folks who've already got ways that work for them, why should they change? Just because outsiders tell them to do it. Let me think. Old-fashioned division of labor, with women doing the farming and the men doing the procurement of meat, whether it's by hunting or whether it's by fishing. This is a division of labor that among Indian people all over the country changes very, very slowly. In some of the central United States, tribes such as the Winnebago, it hasn't changed yet, and men do not like to be involved in farming. It changed slowly and under great duress among the Virginia Indians, and it changed only because they had lost so much of their land base that they had to turn to plow agriculture in order to raise enough on the remaining land. And plow agriculture tends to be associated with animals. Animals tend to be associated with men, and then you get men taking up a plow. They don't usually have Gideac law, they don't put law behind the plow. So you have an essentially anglicized sort of agriculture on these reservations by the early 19th century, and that is documented very well at Pamunkey, and also at another reservation which is no longer with us anymore, called the Jameson over on the Eastern Shore. Let me think. That ought to be enough for economy. I could go on for hours. So far as political organization is concerned, I thought I was written down somewhere else if you wanted. Political organization. The empire came crashing down in 1646, but the monarchical form of government that most of the Virginia tribes have, with the exception of the Chickahominy, of course, survived apparently until about the 1720s. And I'm pulling that out of the air. The last mention in any kind of a document that you find of any kind of royal, that's a queen, by the way, it's a monkey, is in the 1720s. And from the wording of the document, I'm not positive she was alive in that year. They were talking about a deed she had signed. It could have happened earlier. Royalty is expensive to support. If you've lost your land base, if you've lost a lot of your population to war and disease, chances of keeping your royalty going are going to be rather slight. So by the mid-18th century, it is entirely safe to say that the monarchical system was gone and had been replaced probably with a system that had document because it's prehistoric. And that system was one in which the better hunters, the better politicians, and most of these are males, simply got together as a council and ratted things out. The documents that we do have signed by Virginia Indian people, again, mainly reservation, they were the ones who were visible, are signed by the adult males of the group. And you don't even have any one of them signing on as headman until after the 1830s. The change occurred in reservation people after the 1830s because they began to come under pressure from their neighbors, very hostile pressure from their white neighbors. And the headman came to be the man who was literate. There were three or four at Pomoki who were very fluent writers of English. Literacy literally meant survival in those pressured years before the Civil War. And the non-reservation Indians caught on to that about the same time, but their chances for education were even more limited. We'll come to that presently. But you had the emergence of headmen on the reservation about the time that this really serious pressure comes. They didn't appear to be called chief until sometime later. Formal organization of chief and council was reported only by James Mooney in 1899. It probably happened before, but I can't pin it down. And I relied on Pamunkey oral tradition that they would kindly fill me in. So far as the non-reservation people are concerned, it is extremely difficult to keep an ethnic group going if you are trying to be a third race in a biracial state. And all that kind of social pressure on it, real difficult to organize. And consequently, these people stayed more or less quiet, but clustered. And they were clustered. They show up in the census records, they show up in the county records. The clusters of people are there. But there is no direct reference to a formal organization until much later, after the turn of the century. And then they organized in self-defense. That's what it amounted to. The first group to do so among the non-reservation people was the Chickahominy, and they did it because the Jim Crow laws went in. You all remember Jim Crow, separate waiting rooms, separate trains, et cetera, et cetera. And the Chickahominy were finding themselves having to go to Richmond, their nearest market town, in a segregated coach, and they were not exactly thrilled. So they organized. And when they organized, in sheer self-defense, they added in an Anglo style of organization, the chief, assistant chief, secretary, treasurer, that sort of thing. They were already familiar with that sort of organization because they'd been involved in churches for a long time and come into religion. By that time, they had seen an awful lot of the outside world in its ways, and it made sense to imitate it. It would work for the outside world and work for them. But they felt reasonably at home doing it. The organizations that occurred in the 1920s went a step even farther. And they organized under the State Corporation Commission. They had every legal right to do it. It's a little hard to be declared illegal when you're simply setting yourself up as a corporation. Corporations don't usually declare war on the Virginia state government. So it's fairly safe. And it's not surprising that you find the same kind of political setup in corporations with boards of directors that you find in other corporations. It made sense. And they were at home with it by that time because so much of their culture. So, quickly on political organization. This is still the basic kind of organization that the folks have got. It is essentially Anglo-style. It puts an Anglo-style of life, and it makes it much easier for outsiders to deal with, so why not do it? Education. Education is a really ironic thing in Virginia Indian history. In the 17th century, the English were just dying to educate Indians. In the 20th century, Indians were just dying to get educated and whites wouldn't let them do it. There's been a complete turnaround, and the reasons are largely political. In the 17th century, the English idea of education was, of course, to educate people in English culture. And the Indian background was a very different one. The English also had a long-standing tradition, it goes back to at least 1400 AD, of fostering out children, boarding schools in some formal cases, but you don't educate your own children. The Indians looked upon this sort of thing with horror, not only as parents, but also as members of culture that was not English. They regarded the English efforts to educate Indian children as a form of cultural genocide, which was how the English themselves regarded it. You can go read the documents, it's there. The college College of William and Mary began taking in Indian students whose parents were under duress. It was Alexander Spotswood who actually got some of the Indians to begin sending their children, yes, in a sense they were hostages, by telling these folks with their reduced land base and their very genuine poverty, we will remit the tribute that you owe us if you will send some of your kids to the college. And consequently, you have a new kids coming to the college. You have Pamunkey, which then included Matt and I. You got Chickahominy. You got Nancy. All these are recorded. I don't have any record for Rappahannock, sorry, but I think the reservation was gone by that time. It went somewhere around 1705. So you have these Indian kids coming to college, and they stayed coming to college until the Grafferson Fund was discontinued in 1776. The education they got there was basically grammar school, and it was a segregated school. If you can believe Ezra Stiles, I'm sure you're familiar with him, he heard a rumor that, but the white undergraduates got at William & Mary wasn't just a lot better than graduate grammar school. I don't know if he's accurate or not. Nonetheless, it was a grammar school education. More importantly, it established a tradition of literacy, at least among the Pamunkey. Documents are less good than answers, but there was a tradition of literacy among the Pamunkey, and it literally helped them survive later on. Once the Grafferton Fund was over, the reservation kids had difficulty getting formal education in Virginia. And the reason here was political. The society that Indians were living in was largely an anti-Indian one. In the late 18th century, largely neglectful also, benign neglect. The Indian culture had changed enough by about 1800 that they were regarded not so much as real Indians, real as in quotation marks, and it means you have to wear feathers, see. If you don't wear feathers, you're not Indian. Their culture had changed enough that their credibility was poor. And the whites much preferred just to keep them in a general lower category, sometimes called colored, sometimes called other things, but above all, preferably uneducated and not able to do much pressuring of legislatures. And consequently, when Indian folks wanted an education later on, they had just one bear of a time in getting it. They didn't stand a chance of getting it before the Civil War, because the people who had the money to set up educational facilities in Virginia were mostly interested in more private white education anyway. It was after the Civil War, and after my mother's relatives and even my father's relatives, and they brought in the idea of public schools, and then the public schools, of course, had to be segregated. And then it becomes that another expense to set up Indian schools. And we've already heard some reference to the problems that that sort of thing can make for Indians. Nonetheless, it became almost impossible for Indian people to get an education and remain Indian in the eyes of anybody in the outside community. It was a really tough position to be in. A school of one's own, a third racial school in one's county or on one's reservation, therefore became a major marker socially of an Indian community, and I'll return to that. But schools became extremely important, not just in self-defense of becoming literate, but as a social symbol for the entire community. The schools gradually were set up, and when integration came, they were lost again. And I had started working with Indian folks not very long after that integration came. And people were still more or less in a state of shock over it. Most of you remember what it felt like at the time. I'm sorry for the pain, but it really didn't happen. Education these days is still dramatically important. But they have shifted over and gotten another symbol, namely federal funding for education for people with Indian heritage. And it's quite a success story. But education is still a major marker for being Indian. How active you are in your community in getting funds for Indian children is still vastly important. And literacy, definitely. Going hard at it for people I know about. Religion. I'm probably taking too long. Religion. The traditional Powhatan religion was never properly reported by the English because they didn't ever understand very much about it. I tried ratting it out myself, and it has elements of shamanism, elements of southeastern priestly stump, etc., etc., etc. The fact remains, it was a complex religion. It was not devil worship. This Oki that you hear about was more of a vengeful policeman sort of deity. He was not the devil incarnate. The point about religion I want to make with the Powhatan, though, is it was not only complicated in theology, it was complicated in the way it was set up. They had priests, and these were full-time specialists who were going at ceremonial duties and keeping these temples that you saw the pictures of. A full-time priesthood is expensive. It is not something that you can keep up in conditions of poverty when your land base has been eaten away. Therefore, it is not surprising that you don't get any more English mentions of even seeing priests after about Robert Beverley's time, 1705. He apparently saw some. He's the last one to record it. The priests appear to have died out after that time. Powhatan people in the 18th century have almost no mention of what their religious preference is. And judging from what has happened with other Indians along the East Coast, they were probably more or less in a state of limbo. The old religion doesn't mean too much to you if your culture is changing, and also if it didn't help you to win the war. The priests, even while they existed, were having some credibility problems. By late 17th century, priests could predict the future, but they can't tell you what the English are going to do. That qualification had crept in. But the new religion that they were going to pick up, Christianity, didn't mean just a lot to them either, for the simple reason that it still represented an outside alien in society that was still nibbling away at their land and laughing at their way of life. It's not a way to sell your religion if you're going to treat people that way on the street during the week. Add to that that for much of the 18th century, the major church in Virginia was the Episcopal Church, the Anglican Church as it was then. And my fellow Episcopalians are much better at conviviality than they are at evangelizing. So you don't find Indian folks in Virginia joining up with the Episcopal Church. It took some almost outcast Protestant tent people to get the Indians in. And these, by and large, were Southern Baptists. You begin to get itinerant preachers in King William County, and they also held meetings with the same group of people over in Newtown in the 1780s. And that seems to be the beginning of conversion among Virginia Indians. I know less about the Nansemans, sorry. I don't have documents to tell you. Maybe the Episcopalians got you before the Nansemans did. But for the other groups, it was Baptist. And it seems to have happened in the 1780s. When the first Baptist church was organized in King William County in 1791, it had Pamunkeys sign up on the original roll, and they had already been baptized, so that means the baptisms had happened before. I know that there is a Chickahominy oral tradition that says that there was a missionary by the name of Bradley in the 1790s. I found only partial corroboration for him in the documents, and the truth may well lie somewhere in between. He seems instead to have been a farmer who buried in. I don't have any records of a Bradley, neither does a Baptist church, by the way, of a Bradley as a missionary. Nonetheless, the general time period works. So by the late 18th century, you're getting conversions to Christianity. And the Christianity melted in a little bit better with the culture that people practiced because they were becoming anglicized, you see. It had to happen together. So by 1800, then, you've got Christianized Indians. And they have remained as such. Up until the Civil War, they went to church along with all their neighbors. You don't have segregated churches of any kind, really, racially, until the Civil War. After the Civil War, segregated churches, so you have a third Baptist church in the community. That's an Indian one. That became the other major symbol of an Indian community, and it made sense. Organizing the church was also, again, a fairly safe thing to do, even right after the Civil War. Freedom of religion was supposed to be allowed. You form a church, you're not necessarily going to be declaring war on the state of Virginia. So you organize churches, and therefore you get tribal churches, or at least a desire for one. And when the population gets big enough and prosperous enough, yes, they can set up their own churches, and that will be automatically an idea in their time. That covers religion. Let me shift social scientist, entirely the social scientist, to talk a little about ethnicity, the nature of ethnic groups. This is something I've been interested in for about 7 years now, and I guess I studied more Middle Eastern ones than I have any other part of the world. And the Middle Eastern ones are interesting because those are folks. They've got tribes in places like Iran, and they've come under the same kind of pressure that Indian people have from very complex, urbanized governments. It's a really interesting parallel. There's a lot to say about ethnicity, and I'm only going to hit one point. It's the one that's most relevant to here. And if you want to stretch it out in question session, that's fine. The main thing that I want to bring out here is that all ethnic groups change over time in their culture. Culture change is normal. Nobody stays a fossil. If you stay a fossil, you're going to die out. Everybody changes. The only question is how fast they change and in what direction they change. Everybody's going to do it. But that does not necessarily mean that the ethnic groups who've been changing are going to disappear. Far from it. They often change in order to survive. The same people will adopt new modes of dress, new modes of political organization, and they will consider themselves just as validly Egyptian. Let's take an example with Egypt. We don't expect them to dress in these kilts that they call shendis and wear wigs, do we? We can see an Egyptian in a business suit, and we can look at him, and if he says an Egyptian, he's going to hard to tell from a rock, and sorry about that. We believe him when he says an Egyptian. But Indians, we keep expecting to wear feathers. It's not fair. When people change in their culture and still keep their ethnic identity, what they're really doing is changing the symbols of their communities. And it's these symbols that make themselves feel different from their neighbors. So that with the Powhatan, for instance, once the language had changed, and the communities were so small, the language was naturally going to die. Nobody killed it except population decrease. Once language was no longer a marker, well, churches began to be important instead, and schools instead. And if they seem to have an anglicized sort of structure, that's all right, because the lifestyle as a whole was anglicized. The important thing is that Indian people were running, and therefore they were legitimately Indian. They were not run by outsiders, they were run by insiders. To hit briefly the major symbols of Indianness in Virginia from the 17th century on, 17th century, everything was about them was different from the English, so you could pay your money and take your choice. Everything could be symbolic. In the early 18th century, they still spoke a different language. They still had their traditional economy, but much reduced land base. It was hard. But they also had something added by that time, which is still important down to the present day. And it is this heritage of knowing that you are the Aboriginal people of the territory, and the folks around you are not. Heritage, if you want it just in one word, heritage. It is an incredibly bitter experience to be conquered in your own home territory. Anybody who grew up with people who were on the southern side of the Civil War and got licked know that that can last a while. But the Southerners, if they were whites or blacks, had it a bit easier because they were conquered by people who started out being similar. And the wounds have healed reasonably fast. Indians haven't had that. They started out being much different, physically, linguistically, culturally. And when they got conquered by aliens, the scars are much, much slower to heal. So it has been incredibly bitter for them, just as it has been for the Welsh, if you want a parallel case. And the Welsh haven't assimilated after 650 years. So this business of heritage was already important by the early 18th century. By the early 19th century, when so many things had been anglicized, heritage was still there. Land in the case of the reservations, still important. But above all, knowing who your ancestors had been and that they had not been particularly well treated. That was the big point. Early 20th century, by that time, people were trying to show socially because they were under more social pressure. Things had gotten polarized. You've got heritage, you've got reservation land for the reservation folks, you've now got schools and churches. And all these were major symbols. In the present time, they've lost the schools. They replaced it with activity in county schools But they've added yet another thing, and that's community centers. Thanks to some of the heritage monies that are available, or in some cases like in Chickahominy, simply jerking up their socks and raising money. But community centers are a big one in the late 20th century. And there the people are following the crafts, and they do it for the same reason that I make patchwork quilts, because you relate to your heritage. But symbols are still there. Now, I'm supposed to talk about Indians tomorrow, and I left my crystal ball home. But it doesn't really take a crystal ball, after what I've said, to make the point that Indians are probably going to be around for a good long while, for the foreseeable future. If the British have not been able to make the Welsh disappear in 650 years, and those are fairly similar peoples of the British, are we really going to be able to make Indian folks who come from such a different background disappear in only 400 or 500 years? I think not. Ethnic groups will survive. They will find new symbols, but they will go on surviving. The Jews have done it for nearly 3,000 years, and there's no good reason why the Indians shouldn't do it too. They are much changed, and so forth, frankly, is my ethnic group, and I don't live in a log cabin anymore either. There's no reason why they can't change. They will remain Indians, and they will not have to wear feathers to prove it.
See my son's textbook coming home as Indians being an incidental, at best, and often an obstacle to the European expansion in the United States. I am concerned that, that what people, for instance, at your level, do you have any impact on changing that perception? I'm very thrilled about what you and Dr. Costello said. In affecting the way it's taught. I hear what you're saying, and it's wonderful. I know if you can give part of the knowledge, it's not what's going on down the street.
Take 2 seconds. In the last couple of years, a friend of mine at the Newberry Library, which is an Indian History Center, and I have written and given major critiques at the American Historical Association and published in their proceedings, in their publications, which go to thousands of teachers and writers. The one I just gave in December was a critique. I examined all the 16 major textbooks being used in American history courses in colleges, some of which are also used in high schools. And I just looked at the early discovery period, just the first century or so, and attacked practically everything that they did. But not only about the Indians, but about the Spanish and the French and everybody else. I mean, the only people that got remotely right is the English. This other critique was an examination of how the Indians are treated all through the textbooks. We examined again, 16 or 20 of them. That message is out. I mean, I know the textbook publishers are very, very wary of getting people who don't know anything about Indians. I'm getting an idea asked to review the textbooks before, you know, in a manuscript stage. They don't hire people to do the colonial period anymore who don't have some understanding of Indian culture, as well as black culture. I don't know about the seventh grade textbook by Park Rouse and Virginia history. I would doubt like hell if it's worth 2 cents about Indians. But I could be wrong. It just seems to me it takes longer to get down to the lower grade levels because the university people who know the stuff tend not to write those.
We don't get any credit academically for writing popular stuff.
No.
But my concern is even taking the history books in French are Catholics who are ready to attack the American colonies, and then they disappear after the French Indian War, if you will. And I think your point that eventually, pardon me on this, but we all became Indians, as we couldn't have been the Americans we are had not we had contact with the Indians, is so critically important, and yet somehow, it's just not getting there. So, I would like to ask you anything you can do to bring that message, because that course is unswerving. And as I say, I have three sons in school, and I can see even today, without an effort on and reading on their own, they will come to believe that the Indians were there and mostly viewed as a problem to European settlement.
That's a major reason we're here.
We'll
hear from educators this afternoon.
I'd like to address that subject. I can't speak to the public education, but what I see in the museum field is that public school teachers are turning to museums as an alternate form of education to do a lot of the teaching about Indian heritage. And I know that at James Bond Festival Park, we get an incredible amount of inquiries about our Indian program. So there is something done somewhere, if not in public school system, as alternative forms of education to address what's been missing in the form of textbooks and curriculum.
I saw a question
way
back in the show.
I have one question. My daughter was a teacher, and I know that she was a teacher. They don't have nothing there, maybe even a week. So the Indian
that's how we only have time for one more question.
I had a question for you, either you or Doug Haskell, both of you. A good many colleges and universities now have American studies programs, but how many church courses on American Indians within that program?
Was it American Studies? The American Studies programs that I know are primarily about the various European nationalities that came over here.
I know.
And instead, you're going to find special institutes about Native Americans, specifically, as separate institutions. And there's some very good ones around.
There's one program that's going to have a fairly significant Indian content, and that's where the marriage of the PhD in American Studies. If they don't, it'll be over my dead body.
Mr. Oliver Perry would like to say something.
I feel like the question of the gentleman here asked, and I think that the solution is being started at the wrong end. I don't think any of us will live long enough to let, as Reagan says, this trickle-down effect from the top to the bottom. And if you're interested in trying to get the word back into the schools of people in the primary grades, second, third, whatever, I think the people in here have the answer to that. Get off of your butts, get out into the schools, get involved with your PTA, speak to your classes. I'll be a little bit prejudiced here and speak about the management. I don't think as a week that goes by that one or two of us are not speaking out some type of a civic function, schools, historical society, and things like that. We might be 50% wrong in what we say, but at least we are speaking from our own oral history. You have a lot of the scholars today, they read things that have been written by other scholars and form conclusions based upon that. I'm not saying that's wrong or right either, but I think the people here can play a large role in speeding up this process. Go there and tell them, I'm an Indian, I'm a Pamunkey, I'm a Chickahominy, I'm a Nansma, I'm something else. And that makes an impact. So I say, start there, and then let the scholars trickle down.
And with that conclusion, we should get on with our next step in the program.
It's been a very exciting morning, hasn't it? Summarize some of the issues we've heard and possibly some of the issues we have offered. And then we're going to take, because we're going to take about 3 minutes. Well, Randy did 1,200 years, right, Randy?
Well,
that's far from the course.
One of those times when ladies before gentlemen is detrimental to the vein. That would have been a blessing. What I've tried to do in the course of the morning is listen carefully to each of the speakers during the presentation to try and identify patterns that I've seen emerging as they presented information in their areas of expertise, be it Bible history or be it archaeology, ethnohistory, and also to see the patterns that emerged from the types of questions that were raised before. And I thought, in the process of trying to listen and take notes, most of which I cannot read, so the marker for this Indian for the 20th century will have to teach me paper handwriting, is that when one brings scholars and Indian community people together in the same room, it's like taking a transparency and watching an overlay. Yet clearly among Indian people and Indian leaders, there's a collective memory of many things that went on and how the community perceived that they happened and why they happened. Those people as scholars who have chosen to explore that part of the past and try to reconstruct the photograph have also picked up bits and pieces and parts of that same image. However, we do not necessarily bring to that picture quite the same perspective. And because of those differences in perspectives, it raises some interesting issues which I think this group can discuss. In going through them, one of the things that I noticed is that when we look to the archaeologists, it's clear that they can show us a set of tools or a set of skills which we can use to explore the past and to get a sharper, clearer picture in our mind. But it's also clear from the questions that were raised on the floor that an examination of the past is more than an academic study, that our identity is wrapped up in it as people, that there are ethical considerations, there are religious considerations. And one of the questions that's raised as we bring the skills of the archaeologist to examining and clarifying our past is whether or not that process is sensitive to balance the need for respect for religious practices and institutions, and is effective in doing the process of preservation. And I think one of the questions that was clearly raised in the part of that discussion is, are there safeguards to deal with the issue of how excavation sites are handled, how burial sites are handled? Do these safeguards really go far enough? Is volunteerism enough in this instance when we rely on the goodwill and the people to respect these sites? And the second question that's raised, which really relates to that, is
is it a fact of life that these protections are circumvented? Because filming will take place on private land. People will see business necessity as being an excuse for not respecting the burial mound, of not concerning themselves for how the burial, the artifacts and burial sites are treated. So I think one question that lingers out there is, are there really safeguards? And are these effective enough? And what needs to be done to better integrate the skills that the archaeologist brings to us to help us explore our past in our concerns of balancing those skills with what are important values and priorities of our communities? I thought it particularly interesting to listen to the ethnohistorians, because while we like to think of history as being a photograph, it is in fact a photograph very much presented through the eyes of another person who may come from another culture, who may be emotionally involved from a very different perspective in recording that history. And as Dr. Axtell was going through his presentation, the one question that crossed my mind is, where did all these pictures come from? Who drew them? You know, when you're a lawyer, you have a tendency to be obnoxious about these things. And I thought, well, were those people actually on the scene when they drew those pictures? Or did they read someone's accounts? Having done a little bit of reading in history, I know that in some instances, in the 1800s, people read diaries and journals of people who were in fact colonists and then drew pictures based on what they thought things looked like at the time. And I mention that because one of the things that I think we need to be concerned about in bringing together the knowledge we have at a community level and the knowledge scholars bring to us through their research is that these are events written by human beings with a particular perspective. They are not necessarily written at the exact point in time when these events occurred. Sometimes the people who draw the pictures, who write the books, are in fact looking back on them with the hindsight of their own century or their own time period, or never having traveled to the New World, but trying to reconstruct what they think things look like based on journals that they've examined, letters that they've received, documents that have been published at the time. And so one of the questions that is certainly worth pursuing is, how do you manage to put that in the balance? And if distortions have resulted because we have had to rely on other people in past times to be our eyes and ears, how do we eliminate some of those distortions, and how do we clarify and round out that record? And that, of course, brings me to what I think is the very intriguing part of the presentation, which really rounded out Dr. Roundtree, and that is talking about how cultures have changed, how Indian people have been very pragmatic, and as certain practices simply did not function, or certain practices that were imposed on them were not practical for a lifestyle, they simply did not accept them. But that over a period of time, new markers were adopted that served the device of soldering the community together, of keeping the community unified, even when they were living in an environment where political and social forces may have said, we don't want you to be unified. Quite frankly, we don't want you here. And in listening to Dr. Roundtree's presentation, I had wanted to ask both her and Dr. Axtell a question at the end, and that was, we talk about the fact that we need to clarify the record and we need to make people aware of the fact that new badges emerge, that because people are dynamic, they will change the contour of their culture. They will change the badges that they show to the outside world. They will change the institutions that hold them together as a people through good times and bad. And the one thing that occurred to me is, what do we do using the scholars and using the historical process to get mainstream society to let go of its obsession with the badges of past times and to accept the fact that that process is dynamic, and to look for what the new badges are, and to recognize that, like all people, we're people in a state of change, and that part of the process is not our simply rewriting history. Part of the process is a realignment of perspective, of recognizing that we as a people have not been put inside a time capsule, never to change from a certain time forward when the records on us disappeared, but that we have changed subtly over periods of time, and they need to learn to let go of that past and to look for the present edges and the present markers of our community. So it's an education process for us to not only learn how to use history, but for us to explore how we get those people who have traditionally written histories and accepted them as they were written in preceding us to let go of some badges that are no longer relevant. I thought that if those were really the things that would be helpful to focus on for the session this afternoon. And at this point, my helpmate will... Well, Ed is gone.
Of course, the flip side of, I think, the second ago, particularly calling someone as thorough and efficient as Kathy is, and I think she's hit the high spots. I'm pinch-hitting far hard way marks, so the Council of Indians, and I think most of you heard Delegate Marks last night. Sorry he's not here this morning, but I think you recognize him as a friend of Virginia Indians. He's a friend of many other people that I think is getting an award somewhere else. Stepping in for him. What struck me in listening to the different presentations this morning, first of all, as someone who, native Virginian, born in Virginia, put it that way, who was educated in all the Virginia history books that we're all talking about. And what strikes me is not only the concern about clarifying the record of what here before 1607 and what that was like. But even more interesting to me, and I think something that I get questions about all the time, and it just jumps out at me this morning, is the story of what happened after 1700, or why do people believe that there were Indians in Virginia? How do you get across the story of what's happened since then? That to me is the fascinating thing. As a member of the Council on Indians, I guess what I was thinking this morning, particularly in some of the questions, is how can the Council on Indians help to address some of the concerns that come out of this conference? The Council has been in operation now for about 4 years, created in 1983, but effectively for about 4 years. Some of you are familiar with the Council, others may have seen the name but don't know what it does. And I think the Council itself needs to work. I think this conference is going to be very valuable. Last night you heard Delegate Marks and her Secretary T promise to take what comes out of this conference in terms of the need to develop an education curriculum and to go to the State Board of Education, the Department of Education, began to look for ways to address the great questions that you're raising. And I think I and the other members of the Council are looking for this conference and the conclusion this afternoon to point out what the message is that we're to take. It also struck me, going beyond the education issue, is that what role can the Council on the Indians play in these other issues that are raised that very definitely involve questions of Virginia law, Virginia legislature, court decisions in Virginia, legal advice. What place can the Council on Indians play, and where are the other parts of the state government that can help in this? Because I think there's a lot of just lack of information in the state capitol about who's doing what and what could be done. Found out things this morning from presentations that I didn't know these people did that, or that the Attorney General's office was doing this or that. So, to me, that is, I guess, from somebody who's associated with government, that's the question that jumps out at me, is what can be done, what are the specific recommendations?
Thank you very much. Well, we're going to take a lunch break. You haven't had much break time this morning. And it's also going to be that kind of an afternoon. So if you could please have lunch and get back here by 2. We have rearranged the program a little bit, as I described this morning. And there will be more time for dialogue this afternoon. And we will be able to address some of the issues that I described. And then by Kathy McKee, and then bring out some of the issues that surfaced on the floor and get those to be hopefully more satisfactory plan of action this afternoon. Thank you very much to the scholars this morning and to the audience. And I would like to see us.